Shocking evidence, jury drama, and witness cross-examinations. The Case of podcast takes you inside the biggest trials in the country, reporting the in-depth detail of how courts work and who's in there each week. We've brought you Erin Patterson's mushroom murder trial, the case of Toya's murder in Cairns, a Canberra cold case, the two intruders, and many more. Search for The Case Of, it's on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
ABC Listen, podcasts, radio, news, music and more.
When the painter Paula Modison-Becker first exhibited her work, it was criticised as ugly, uncouth, a display of lawless subjectivity. Paula was not cowed. She went on to paint the world and herself through her own eyes, including a remarkable painting of herself naked and as though pregnant, one she made in 1906 when she was 30 years old and living by herself in Paris. Paula is one of the artists that Drusilla Majeska writes about in her book, A Woman's Eye, Her Art. Drusilla has been writing about the lives of women, particularly women artists, for many decades. Her prize-winning books include Poppy and Stravinsky's Lunch. Drusilla's latest book celebrates not only the creativity of the artists that she writes about, but it also explores their audacity and their deep bonds of friendship. Hi, Drusilla.
Hi, Sarah.
You were born in England just after the end of the Second World War. How did you come by the wonderful name Drusilla?
My parents, they'd met just before the war. They were very, very young, far too young, hardly knew each other. Then he'd have to go off to the war, so on and so forth. My mother was pregnant with me and they'd only just discovered they're pregnant. They were somewhere, I think it might have been Devon or Cornwall, and they were at a Drusilla's tea shop. And so they decided if I was a girl, they'd call me Drusilla, but the Drusilla was a D-R-U-S-C-I-L-L-A, and that was what was put on my birth certificate. But then I had an uncle who was a bishop of Hereford, I think, and he said he wouldn't christen me unless they changed the birth certificate to have my spelling D-R-U-S-I-L-L-A.
Why?
Because Drusilla with a C was a whore in the Apocrypha, whereas Drusilla with an S was a noble Roman lady, even though Caligula disemboweled his sister called Drusilla. So obviously it was very much better to be a disemboweled noble lady than the nice healthy whore.
Who ran a tea shop. So tell me a little more about your parents' experiences in the war before you came along. Was your dad involved in active service?
Yes, he was just 20 when the war began, and he was a sort of intellectual, short-sighted, bookish kind of a man. Because he'd been at private school, public school, they call them in England, he was sent off to train to be an officer. And he got sent first to Africa and then to India, doing all these ridiculous things. And he met my mother just at the beginning of the war. They met, and she was 16, or just coming up for 16. And she, to my grandfather's fury, she left the family home and went off to be a fanny, an F-A-N-Y, in the war.
What was a fanny?
A fanny, I think what it was called was the First Aid Nursing Yeomanry. And she was in a country house somewhere. Her father couldn't even send letters to her. She was there and they were coding. They were working with the Polish airmen who were in England, getting trained up to be dropped back behind the lines. So they had to prepare them, so every single thing, there was nothing that could possibly look like they'd been in England. Then they had to know the codes, so when the codes came back.
But and she was, what, 17 or something?
Well, she was 16 when she joined the Fanny, so then by the end of the war, when they came back, I think they'd both had quite, traumatic things. And the 50s, as you would know, was a kind of conservative period, so that little glimpse of some sort of independence she might have had. she's back home and hearth, being a mother and a wife.
What were things like between your mum and dad when you were little? How do you remember that?
I think when we were really little, it was probably quite good. We had a little house in the country outside London, and my memories from that were good. But then things, you know, started to go wrong. And I think it was just a very difficult era for women in particular. And I think for the men, they kind of had to repress, you know, repress his emotions so that they can go out and, you know, climb the next mountain and save the empire, all that kind of stuff. So all the things my father saw during the war, all that happened, which he very rarely spoke of, you know, I think had to be kind of repressed and held down. So I think he couldn't cope with emotion. And I think my mother was quite emotional. And she, my memories from the time I was about 10 were her standing at the door saying, "Patrick, Patrick, please, please listen to me." And he'd be sort of there shaking his chair with a book held up to his face, saying, "Please, oh, please, Pookie, leave me be."
What changed in your family, Drusilla, when you were 13?
I was about 12. My mother had what was those days called a nervous breakdown. And she was in a psychiatric hospital for quite some time. She'd come back during the holidays sometime. And for me, I think it was a kind of foundational trauma, probably, because I got sent away to school, boarding school, down in Dorset. And I probably remembered the school a bit harshly. It probably wasn't as bad as I remember, but I remember it as just sort of awful. And talking about repressing emotion, I think if a child in that situation turned up at school today, they'd probably be cancelled out of existence. But for me, it was sort of, you know, absolutely not. And don't make a fuss. Don't put yourself forward. You know, off to your class. No, no, no.
Was that the end of your parents' marriage, that time that your mum spent in that psychiatric unit?
No, it staggered on for another few years. And during my teen years, I think they were waiting for my younger sister to be 16. And then my father left and it was sort of terrible. It was a very conservative kind of part of England. And for me, I could not get out of it fast enough.
So how did you plot a way out of England as a young woman?
Well, I left school saying I was never going to read another book and I was never going to write another essay. That was it. Over. Finished. I was going to have fun. And I think I kind of broke my father's heart because he really wanted me to go to university and be in the professions. And I said, no way, I'm going to Secretarial College, and I'm going to Secretarial College in Oxford because I'm going to have a whole lot of fun.
And did you?
Yeah, I did. I had a whole lot of fun. And while I was having fun, I met this American who was an anthropologist, and he was going to then go and do a PhD at ANU. But first of all, they said, do you go to Papua New Guinea and teach at the university there for a while to learn about Papua New Guinea and then go to Australia and do a PhD? So he was very young, very nice man. We're still friends, but we were far too young. We got married and had to get married because I couldn't get a passport without my father's signature because I was under 21 and he wouldn't sign unless I was married. But I think you don't have to be Dr. Freud to think why I was drawn to Nick Majeska. Nice though he was. The thought of getting out of England and Papua New Guinea, which I didn't have a clue where Papua New Guinea was, but I mean, let me out of here. And it was a transformative experience.
So you turned up in Port Moresby in Papua New Guinea at the age of 20.
I was 21 by the time 21. We got there, just 21.
What were your first impressions? How did the place strike you?
Well, we were at the university, which had just opened, and it was fabulous. I didn't think I'd go to university because I was never going to read another book, you know, all of that. But when I went to some of the wives' tea parties in the morning, I realised that I was back in Hampshire. And so I then realised that because I had my A-levels, I could actually enrol, and I enrolled in history. And, you know, sort of has come from the world of empire and has never thought about colonialism. And my world just went whoops and turned right upside down, and suddenly I saw it all from the completely different perspective.
So this was the lead up to independence. What do you remember about the conversations and the energy on the campus in Moresby?
I just remember it as, you know, quite a wonderful time. And I used to work the Roneo. You're probably too young to know about Roneos.
Was it like a printer? What's a Roneo?
It was sort of like a printer. It was before photocopiers. And we had, there was a student newspaper. I used to kind of like hanging out around the edges a bit shyly of the students' union. And I used to offer to, with the Roneo, when they came off, there was a big handle. You had to crank round and round. And I'd offer to do that because... And they were really interesting people, the people with names that people might recognise, like Rabbi Namelu, Leo Hannett, Bart Filliman, and they all went on to be very significant in what happened afterwards. And they were all doing plays. All these young Papua New Guineans were writing plays, and I remember sort of watching all of them and hanging out. So it was very, very exciting and really shifted my perspective.
Papua New Guinea has this extraordinary visual culture. What did you make of that art, you know, which was so different from the art you would have grown up with in England?
I think I didn't really understand it. One of the things that's been so interesting in the trajectory of the work I've done since is discovering the surrealists in Europe in the 20s and 30s, and how for them Papua New Guinea was the visual art, oceanic art from the Pacific, the carvings, the batiks, the kind of images, and particularly the carvings, were very, very significant to them. And so at first I was really excited when I saw this. There you are, it just goes to show how important Oceania is. And they drew a surrealist map of the world, which had Papua New Guinea in the centre of it, and England and America was this teeny-weeny little bit off to the side. But then it did take me a while to realise how very Eurocentric their understanding of surrealism was, and how they projected onto it this kind of notion of the primitive as being some kind of unconscious connection that they could draw on.
Drusilla, did you ever project your own colonial perspective onto life in PNG?
It was really interesting. When my father died, the only large thing I actually had shipped out was my father's desk, which I love. And in it, when it arrived, were two lots of letters that he'd kept, and one, which really does show the kind of repression of the feminine, were all his letters to my grandmother, his mother, from the time he was sent to school at 7, all the way through until the war, till the end of the war. But there was also all the letters I'd written to him, which were aerograms, which I'd written every week from Papua New Guinea. And when I read them, in the letters, I was saying, we're so radical, we're the anti-colonialists, and we're changing everything, and we're anti-imperialists, and da-da-da-da-da-da-da. I refractory pleased myself. Then I would read, I'd tell him a story. One of them was how we'd gone with some friends to a beach which had a village at the end of it. So it was a beach, sort of attached to village. And we'd go and put all our stuff down. We're all white, young. Go for a walk down to the other end of the beach, and when we come back, some of the food that we'd got disappeared. We had no idea that to walk onto somebody's beach was like, you know,
going into my living room.
Going into your living room or thinking your porch looks like rather a good place to have a... So we go in, we go to the missionary, and I think it was Nick what goes off with the missionary, and they find out where it is and the food's been eaten, but we get back, you know, whatever it was, the tablecloth. Anyway, because we're so terribly radical and so tremendously anti-colonial, we said, no, we didn't want the police to come. And I read this story and I thought, we had no idea what we had done.
You didn't understand the culture that you were a part of.
So even though it was transformative and I did get to see things from a different perspective, it was still a very Eurocentric kind of view. And it took a much, much longer for me to understand that.
You also mentioned that you found your father's letters to his mother in that desk. What was in them?
Oh, it was the most extraordinary thing. So they start at 7 and they end in 1945. And remember what I was saying about the repression of the feminine thing. So the first letters, 7 years old, little boy handwriting, darling mummy. Every single letter starts, darling mummy. Darling mummy, I am most terribly very upset. It is awful here. Please come and get me as soon as you can. Darling mummy, it goes on like this. Within a year, it's darling mummy. Cricket was spiffing. Jones flushed my specs down the lavatory. It was a lark. As it goes on, there's less and less of a darling mummy when you're coming to get me. And it goes all the way through. You can just see that kind of repression of the feminine, of the emotion. When it gets to the end of the war, the very, very end of the war, he comes back and marries my mother in 1945, and in May, just a few days after the war has ended, and they have a honeymoon. And then he is sent back to Burma, where they're mopping up, as it was called, pushing the Japanese back out of it. And he writes to his mother, darling mummy, please do not worry. The chaps know exactly what they're doing, and we're seeing an awful lot of jolly, interesting countryside. I only saw my father cry 3 times in my life. Once was I happened to be in England when Winston Churchill died and my father was watching his funeral on the television. A second time was when I told him I'd been with my mother when she died and I told him about that. And the third time was when he was telling me a story about the war. He very, very rarely spoke of the war, but he told me about when he was in Burma. So he was a young officer, 24, and they had to go into what he described as foxholes, and they'd find a lot of the Japanese soldiers who had done harakiri, who had suicided with the knife in their stomachs. When he was crying, he told me, they'd gone into one, and there were all these dead Japanese, and there was one boy hunched back in a dark corner, holding the knife over his stomach and weeping because he couldn't put the knife into his stomach. And my father said he was a boy. He didn't even have beard hair. He had a smooth face. He can't have been much more than 14 or 15. He had to both comfort this boy and say, you're not a coward. There will be another life after the war. There'll be other things that we can do. And simultaneously arrest him and take him where there'd be other Japanese in front of whom he would be humiliated for not having killed himself.
Back in Papua New Guinea, you started reading again. How was your literary imagination expanding while you were there?
It was just incredible. I read Franz Fanon, I read James Baldwin, I read Simone de Beauvoir, I read Virginia Woolf, I read Rilke. And so much for never reading another book. It was kind of like, let me at it.
So having this chance to read widely and live in such a different place, how did it start changing your own sense of what your future might look like?
Well, you know, it was quite a critical time because I think it was sort of clear that Nick and I had married much too young and we remained friends. It wasn't terrible. And we separated. And for me, I think it was sort of the beginning of a bit of a reckoning. I didn't want to go back, having made a fuss about insisting on getting married so I could travel. I didn't want to go back and say, I didn't want to say any of that. I didn't want to go back to that world. I got a place at ANU, so I went there. But they were tricky years.
Were you imagining that you might want to write yourself in those days?
Well, I think, for, you know, that 1950s and being English, a girl like me, we weren't writers. Writers were Dickens and Milton, and my mother kept some of the essays and that we'd written as children at primary school, and there was one in which I was saying I was going to be a ballerina, and and dance on a stage in the north of England. So I think being a ballerina was much more sort of imaginable.
Were you a good ballerina, Drusilla?
No, I was absolutely hopeless.
So you came to Australia to study at ANU. What did you study there?
I did history because I just loved history. I hadn't realised, but I loved history. And I knew nothing about Australia. I knew nothing. And so what I did, the person who's never going to read another book, I took myself to the ANU library and I sort of worked my way down the Australian literature shelves. And I didn't find any of the kind of Henry Rawson, all those things. Like, they didn't connect to me at all. But the women writers of the 20s and 30s did. And when I'd been in Sydney before going down to ANU, I'd been, you know, was I going to stay? How would I find the courage to stay? Da-di-da-di-da, all that stuff. I found in a second-hand shop in a bookshop in George Street, I found Christina Stead's For Love Alone. And that had a huge impact. And I thought, if Teresa Hawkins could do it that way, I can do it the other way.
This generation, I mean, earlier than Christina Stead, really, this generation of pre-war writers in Australia, I mean, this became a fascination that's continued, that era in history of women's creativity. What are some of the characteristics of women who were making art, writing, painting in that era between the wars?
Well, I think they were dealing with a lot of the same kind of questions that my generation, all of us lot, were dealing with in the late 60s, 70s, 80s. And they were asking the kinds of questions that the women in, you know, the women artists I've written about since were there, and that Paola Modersohn Becker calls the puzzle of herself. She doesn't know why she has to keep painting, why she can't stand doing the housework, how she can't, you know, she can't give her life over to making beef stock. She has to be a painter. She doesn't know why any of this is. And what I have come to call the deep grammars of gender, that kind of deep assumptions of what the role of a woman is, that, of course, Simone de Beauvoir talks about, Virginia Woolf talks about, and our generation coming again, having been, you know, the 50s, when all these women were forgotten, pushed back into house and hearth. We were born in that world. No, 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 don't put yourself forward, be a ballerino, that sort of stuff. Suddenly realising that these questions had been asked before. We didn't know that they were laying a path for us that we were treading, and how really important all of that was to see how there's this long history. And it goes back before them, of course.
But there had been this time of kind of radical questioning and
exactly.
activity, which then the war kind of quashes, that, that is. Massive historical event where everyone's put back in a box, really.
Yeah, very much.
So you were piecing together the stories of women artists, women writers, you know, women who'd done unusual and extraordinary things in their era. But it also led you to start thinking about more ordinary women's stories, such as your mother's, and went from this researching these artist stories into that of your own mum's story. What did you learn when you went back and looked at her with this kind of critical intelligence that you developed looking at other stories?
My mother died in 1984. She was only 59. It was terrible. And I realised how I left England. I was on my way finding this new world I was, you know, running towards. But what was I running away from? What was left undealt with? What have you left behind? So, yes, so I wrote Poppy after my mother's death as really a way of me trying to think, how was I going to move forward from this? And I was, you know, I was coming up for 40. And, yeah, it was a very tough moment.
You were starting psychoanalysis at the same time.
I realised writing Poppy was doing a lot, but wasn't really dealing with it, and I went into psychoanalysis. And that was another transformative experience for which I'm deeply grateful, because it did take me back into that kind of thing of understanding our strengths and our weaknesses, our vulnerabilities and our potential can be so interlinked. And you can see what that triggers, and you can see what you do as a way of trying to hold on to something that was taken from you when you were 12 or 13.
With that different perspective, I guess, on particularly that moment in your life where you at 12 and your mum's taken from the family and has this psychiatric breakdown, I mean, did you start to see even the terms of that differently, like a sense that for women like your mum, part of that was almost social protest?
Exactly. After she died, we found a lot of letters when she was in the psychiatric hospital from the psychiatrist to my father saying, "Don't you worry, we'll have her home again, safe and sound, the lovely wife and mother she's always been." I look at that and think that is precisely the problem.
They wanted to kind of restore her place in that family system. Yep. That was the focus of the care.
Exactly.
With that, looking back at your mother's life after she died, Drusilla, I mean, how did you think, say, about her experiences during the war? How did that time in her life appear to you differently?
Realising that for her it was a sort of moment of independence away from her father. She wasn't yet married. The father was fairly controlling, her father. I rather suspect that I may be wrong just from the photos and from various things she said and various things my Aunt Betty. I think that she had fallen rather in love with one of the Polish airmen who were dropped back into Poland, and that there was never any message from him. She never knew what happened to him. Presumably he was killed.
Drusilla, you mentioned your Aunt Betty as someone you weren't terribly interested in when she was alive. But what did you find out about her wartime experiences?
Well, she was exactly the same age as my mother. She was my father's younger sister. And she had also been a fanny. But unlike my mother, she'd been very good at coding. And it wasn't until I was really after both my parents had died that we found out, 4 days after the end of the war, she was in a plane that landed in Cologne with people from special operations in it, special ops in it. And she was the only, or if not the only, there were very few women on that plane. And the reason she was there is that she knew all the codes, which were lines from poetry, from all the people who had been dropped back. So when they were in the DP camps and, you know, the kind of chaos of Europe, if somebody came forward and could recite the right line from the poem, she'd know exactly who they were.
How extraordinary.
And then she went on to work for MI6, and she always said, oh, she was a sort of a secretary type of thing. And she was in Bangkok, but she used to get flown around all over the place, and she'd talk about she was doing this, and you think, she can't have just been being a secretary. And then when she was about in her late 20s, she was back in England, and my grandfather said, you're going to have to get married, otherwise you'll be on the shelf. And she married Uncle Terence.
What sort of fellow was Uncle Terence?
Oh, God, he was so boring. He was just dreadful. He used to sit in his chair with one of those tables that you get in hospitals on wheels, the little narrow things that wheel over your chair, and make aeroplanes and things. And I remember her, you know, when I was visiting her or we were away on a holiday or something with my sister and my cousin. My cousin and I were talking about some sort of affairs we'd been having or something or other. And she suddenly looks at us and she says, oh, I do wish I'd been like you. And when I was in Bangkok, there were all these girls there and they used to be married before they were married. But I always thought I should not do it, not be married before I was married. I should keep married for when I was married.
She was meaning sex, is she?
I think she was meaning, that's what we realised she was meaning. And then she said, and then I married Terence, and Terence had low blood pressure.
Wow, so the woman that you'd met or known were really behind that facade was some extraordinary history and past and courage. Mm. With this most recent book, A Woman's Eye, Her Art, you turn your attention to women who did live in the public eye in terms of their role as artists, as creators. Let's start with Paula Modersohn Becker, who's often referred to as the first modern woman artist. Tell me about what it was like for you to see her paintings in the flesh, as it were, the first time you did in Germany. How did they strike you? What are they like?
In particular, that one when she painted herself pregnant when she wasn't pregnant, 1906, and she just left Otto Modersohn, her husband. It doesn't reproduce very well because it's a tempera paint, which is a matte, and then she would put little dots, specks, little tiny specks of white on the top of oil, and that makes it actually quite hard to photograph. And when you see it in person, it's also almost life-size, so it's large, and it is radiant. And the thing, of course, that gets everybody who sees it is she has these large painted black eyes that are looking straight down into yours.
So this painter, this woman, grew up in Germany. And did she always know she wanted to be a painter? Was that how she saw herself from a young age?
She absolutely saw herself as that. She said, "I see the world with the mind of a painter." Her father was saying, "But in this world, you can't possibly be a painter. You'll never be able to make anything of yourself. You're going to have to learn housekeeping. And, you know, you're so willful and difficult, you may not get married, so you've got to be able to have some other, you know, do the governess exam so you can be a governess." And she said, "I won't, I won't, I won't. I've got to be an artist." And she did become an artist, but very, very few of her works were seen during her lifetime.
The first place she went off in 1899, I think, to study, where was that?
Most of her youth was spent in Bremen in northern Germany, where her father worked for the Prussian Railway Company. And about 30 kilometres to the north of it was a place called Wurzenwerder, which was where an artist colony had been set up. And her father let her go and study with one of the founders. And she met her very, very important close friend, Clara Westhoff, and she also met Otto Modersohn, who she did marry there. So it was a very significant place. And that was where, when she was, her paintings were included in an exhibition of Wurzenwerder works. That's when she got criticised as being ugly and uncouth and expressing all this unlawful subjectivity.
It's an amazing phrase. Go on.
It's a fabulous phrase, lawless subjectivity. You probably suffer from it, Sarah. I certainly do. But it's like seeing things with her own eyes, which is sort of an affront to the noble history of German art and the noble German folk and so on.
As you say, she ended up marrying one of the founders of that artist colony, Otto Modersohn. But then she did this very radical thing after a few years and left him and his daughter. Where did she go?
She went to Paris. She'd been to Paris a few times. When she'd been in Paris, she'd discovered Cézanne. She was very sort of impressed by the Impressionists and then the Post-Impressionists. And this was considered the ugly, uncouth modern. Otto Modersohn, like most of the painters in Wurzenwerder, were very much against the moderns. And so in 1906, she leaves Otto, and there were various problems in the marriage. She leaves Otto and goes to live in Paris for the year.
And what impact did that year living alone have on the way she painted? How did her work change in that period?
It's a kind of huge period of her work. And during that day, she painted a huge amount. She had to still keep writing to Otto saying, "No, I cannot come back to you, but please would you send me some money? I haven't got any money." And she wasn't selling. She couldn't get into the kind of ecosystem of art. She couldn't get exhibited. But she also had an affair during that time. And it's when she started painting the nude self-portraits. And they are kind of extraordinary. And I think that for her, some of her early works, you see these terribly sad eyes. This woman who saw so much was just trying to find a language for that kind of the grammars of gender. She was one of the first people trying to parse it. You know, she was dealing with all of this, but she was so little seen. And I think it was about seeing and being seen, being both the artist and the woman.
There's such a obviously long tradition of nudes in Western art. What was different about the way Paula painted herself naked?
Women had painted nudes for a long time, and somebody like Artemisia Gentileschi, all those years ago, centuries before, is thought that she used her own body, but they were not presented as self-portraits. They'd be, you know, her famous one of Susanna and the Elders.
So Susanna, biblical figures or mythological figures.
Whereas she did say, called them self-portraits. And, of course, the self-portrait in art history is kind of thought to be the man with his brush at the easel. And the nude was the object that the artist was painting and was the woman, and very often had her gaze turned away so that the people looking could enjoy looking.
But without thinking she was a person.
Yeah.
Who had her own opinion, her own lawless subjectivity.
No lawless subjectivity, no embarrassment. You know. But what Paula and other women were doing, it was trying to do, it's that turning back the male gaze. It's like her eyes come straight into you. And when I looked at those, it was like she's saying, have a good look and have another look.
So she's there making this extraordinary art, living alone, very happily. Why do you think she left Paris and went back to Germany and back to Otto?
Well, it's a complex story. It wasn't the only factor, but a major factor was what she called the eternal money worries. She could not make a living. There were other things as well, and there were a lot of the men around her saying, look, you belong there. You can't do it this way. And so in the end, she went back to Otto.
And what happened, Drusilla, after she returned to Otto?
I mean, Otto wasn't a bad man. He accepted her back, even though he was kind of known as the cuckolded husband. He'd been kind of publicly humiliated. He went to Paris and spent at the end of that 1906, and he spent the winter with her. By the time she went back to Vorpsavede, she was pregnant. She had the baby at the end of the year in November.
And what happened after she had baby Matilda?
She was kept in bed for just over 2 weeks, 18 days. Even though her mother was worried because she was complaining about cramps in her legs, finally, after 18 days, they said, OK, you can get up, and family and friends were waiting in the next door room. She asks for a mirror. She plaits her hair. She puts a flower in her hair. She gets up, takes Otto's hand, walks into the room where everyone's waiting for her and collapses with a pain in her leg and dies of a pulmonary embolism. And her last words was Shada, which means pity.
Another artist who you write about, who's less well known, I think, because Paula Modersohn-Becker then does become a figure in modern art and seen as a significant artist. But someone else you write about is Claude Cohn, though that wasn't the name with which they began life. Tell me about the remarkable Claude.
The remarkable Claude. Well, we fast forward to the First World War. So, I mean, all the kind of things, the kinds of freedoms that Paula had wanted and had been not possible were becoming possible after that war. What a huge difference that war made. Claude Cohn, who'd been born as Lucy Schwab, and her father was a newspaper owner in France, and her mother was non-Jewish, married into this intellectual Jewish family, and she had been put into an asylum when Lucy was very small.
How did she come to change her name from Lucy to Claude?
Well, she was non-conforming, non-binary, non-everything. And she fell in love with a young woman called Suzanne Malherb when she was 14 and Suzanne was 16. And she was the daughter of family friends. And they were in, you know, could easily have ended up in an asylum. They had to, it was really, you know, they had to take long walks into the country to conceal passions that I do not wish to burden you with.
Do not trouble the ABC, the listeners of the ABC with. So they became lovers, these two women, and maintained this partnership then for the rest of their lives. What sort of art did they make together?
Well, what they did, you asked me about them changing their names. So they, at the end of the war, they changed their names to Claude Cahun and Marcel Moore. And then they went to Paris and they became part of the whole kind of queer avant-garde, the sort of surrealist, queer surrealist world. Claude thought of herself as a writer, and she actually wrote quite a lot during that period. But the two of them had a very old 1915 Kodak camera, and they made all these photographs. So they were working with photography. They'd just pin a black cloth up behind them, and it would be mostly Suzanne with the camera and Claude with the masks and the masks. You know, she'd talk about the masks and the masquerades of femininity. So it was like tearing away, what is it? The eye that sees, the eye, the capital I that is, with the multiple selves, who are we, what are we expected to be? And then she'd shave all her hair off, and then she started putting images together. So it was really, really kind of interesting. And the straight men surrealists, finds like André Breton and people, did not know what to make of her, with her hair dyed pink and her harlequin jackets, and she'd come into the cafe and the men would have to scamper.
Claude and Suzanne Marcel moved together to the Channel Island of Jersey in 1938 when they were in their 40s. And then as war breaks out, the Second World War breaks out, the Nazis invade Jersey. What happened to those two women?
One of the ways they survived was that when Suzanne's father died, Claude Cahun's father married Suzanne's mother. So they became stepsisters. And then they could kind of be, you know, hiding in plain sight.
So unlike Paula, they had a financial support.
Base.
And they moved to Jersey, and then the Nazis invade. And what happened?
When the German occupation began, they refused to register Claude Cahun as Jewish and Suzanne Malherb as a German speaker. And then as the war, the occupation goes on, they realise the kind of courage that they'd used before has to take a very different shape. And they start to leave little anti-Nazi things around the island. And then slowly then they come and they create this soldier with no name who becomes a character who writes letters and writes little propaganda things and drops them all over the island. They have an illegal typewriter. They have the ribbons in the typewriter of different colours, and they have carbon paper, so they can make different colours, and they put them under windscreens of trucks. They walk round the island, and they've stopped wearing the outrageous clothes they used to wear. They were very kind of, you know,
Middle-aged lady
clothes, and they've got those middle-aged ladies' handbags like the Queen used to have, and they'd put all their leaflets in there, and they'd walk around being middle-aged ladies, and they'd drop all these leaflets into pubs. They'd put them in the pockets of German uniforms that were waiting to be washed at the laundromat or whatever the laundry was, and it was going all over the island. Oh, and they'd create fictitious meetings of resistance groups here and there across the island. And so the German field police, which were the equivalent of Gestapo on the island, would think there must be a mastermind. So actually, for once, gender was going their way.
They weren't suspicious as middle-aged women.
two middle-aged women with their handbags couldn't possibly be doing this. So it takes them up 4 years before they figure out that they're involved. And even when they figured that out, they think there has to be a mastermind on the mainland. And they arrest them in July of 1944, which is just a month after D-Day. Also in their handbags, they always had Gardner, which was a barbiturate, so that if they did get caught, they could swallow that and suicide.
And is that what they did?
So they immediately took the Gardner, and by the time they got them to the prison, they were unconscious, but they'd got the dose wrong. So they survived, but they were in jail all the way through until May of the next year. But the really extraordinary thing is they still, right to the end, they were still interrogating them. And one of the things I just love about Claude Calhoun, this story, and I think, would I ever have the wit to be able, or the courage to do it? They were up before a Nazi court and they were condemned to death for sedition and being traitors. And also 6 years of servitude for having kept their radio, and another 6 months of servitude, I think maybe for the camera, something else. And Claude, standing there, having just been sentenced to death, says immediately, which comes first, death or servitude? And they say death, and she says, well, when do we do our servitude?
They managed to survive that imprisonment and live, despite that death sentence, they survived the war and the liberation of Jersey. How was Claude Calhoun's artwork remembered?
She died in 1954. Marcel Moore lives on for another 20 years, and she kept all of the papers, but it's all been boxed up and kept out of sight. Nobody knew anything about it until it was auctioned in the 1970s and then went into the Jersey Heritage Trust and became an archive in the 90s. So it was not until the 1990s that her work was known.
Drusilla, you also write about the contemporary Australian artist Julie Rapp, who decades later was really asking the same kind of questions about gender that Claude Calhoun and Paula Modison-Becker were. How did your friendship with Julie Rapp begin?
Well, I'd known Julie for ages, you know, kind of around the traps. We both live in Sydney. We both know a lot of the same people. And I knew her art. But it wasn't until I began this book and I just started thinking, this is Julie. You know, she's a contemporary surrealist in a lot of ways. And so we started just talking about it. And one of those kind of wonderful friendships that grow out of the difference and similarities of our work, me as a writer, her as an artist, but kind of looking at many of the same things. And I'd sort of take things and I'd say, what do you make of this self-portrait of Claude's, or what do you make of this nude by Dora Maar with this monstrous shadow behind it? What's going on? And so we're talking. She was, you know, really generous, and we got to be really good friends, and we took to having fish and chips takeaway on Sunday nights, and we'd natter on about all this stuff. And for me, looking at these women, could any of them have done what they did without that kind of network and the support of the other women who were trying to get to understand some of the same things that, you know, Paula saw as a puzzle of myself? I don't know why I behave this way and I get so, you know, I behave so badly when I'm made to learn housekeeping. It must be fate. I just am like that. It's a puzzle. I'm a puzzle. But for these next generation of women, that puzzle becomes very political. They understand what that is. And, of course, then all of that gets closed down after the war. And it's sort of Julie and my generation, all of us who are doing it, again, the feminists of the 70s and 80s, the personal is political. And I think we have to remember that.
You include an artwork from Julie Rapp that she made in 2024, Somos, or Standing on My Own Shoulders. Can you describe that artwork?
It was exhibited at a big exhibition of hers in Museum of Contemporary Art in Sydney in 2024, as you say. So she'd been making it all through 2024. And she made a bronze cast of herself naked, as she is now. She's a few years younger than me. She's 75, I think. And then she's got another one. She's life-size, naked Julie, standing on her own shoulders, cast in bronze. It's an absolutely fabulous work, and people were just, I was watching people being fascinated by the exhibition. And Julie and I have never argued, but it wasn't exactly an argument, but as she was making it, and she was absolutely clear she wanted to call it Standing on My Own Shoulders, I kept saying, but Julie, we don't just stand on our own shoulders. We stand on the shoulders of all who've been before, all these women we've been talking about. And she said, I know, but when it comes to it, we have to stand on our own shoulders. Anyway, we went on with this backwards and forwardsing on it. And then I came to realise, or we came to realise, that actually both things are true. That when we stumble and fall, as inevitably all of us does, we do have to lift ourselves up and we do have to get back on our own shoulders, and there is no one who can do that for us. But part of the strength that we find in ourselves to pick ourselves up and to stand back there comes from all that we know that has gone before, all of those around us who are saying, go on, Julie, you can do it. Up. You can do it. All the people who were there when I was writing Poppy, saying, you can do it. Actually, you can find a voice to express this. You don't have to do it the way the men have done it. You can do it differently. Go on. Go on. And I can't. You can. So both of those things become true. And also, of course, the wonderful thing about art and the trickster is you can do the impossible, because in actual fact, in reality, the one shoulder we can never stand on, even if you're the most wonderful circus performer, are your own shoulders. And art can kind of let us go into the possible and the impossible. And I feel like in this, with all the geopolitics of the world, everything is happening, I feel like it's really important for us to hold on to that, to the sense that the winds of change can blow in both directions. The thing that we thought was secured and safe and freedom and acquired may not be, but we have to hold on to both the strength that comes to us from knowing that past, knowing that courage has gone before, by holding on to each other and all that we could do, because when we stumble, that is going to help us find the courage, the strength within us to continue on.
Drusilla, it's been fascinating to talk to you. Thank you so much for being my guest on Conversations.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Podcast and broadcast. This is Conversations with Sarah Kanoski.
My guest on Conversations today was the writer Drusilla Majeska, and Drusilla's latest book is called A Woman's Eye, Her Art.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Sarah Kanoski. For more Conversations episodes, head to ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.